Today's show is sponsored by Ting. Go to dancarlin.ting.com and save $25 off your first Ting device when you sign up.
Taking you to nonpartisan places you've never been to and leaving you there. It's Common Sense with Dan Carlin.
There's a bunch of things I'd like to get into today. It had originally started as sort of one topic, something I actually think we've spoken about before in the program. I'd be surprised if we hadn't. But it's been so long since we last did a show. Did you miss me? Because we had part six of a six-part hardcore history series going on. But a lot's happened since the last time we spoke. And judging from some of your comments on Twitter, and you can follow us at DC Common Sense if you want to, many of you wanted to hear me talk, for example, about what has occurred in Baltimore since the last program we did. I know it probably sounds like ancient history, doesn't it? It's kind of out of the news now, which is kind of an angle I wanted to get into for a second. I figure I'll talk a bit about that, a bit about another subject maybe, and then sort of maybe morph into, if I can artfully tie it together with the subject I wanted to get into today. But the Baltimore situation, if you get this show in 5 years and you have no idea what we're talking about, we are in the middle of a growing sense of outrage on the part of some, I guess that's fair to say, over, let's call them, fatal encounters between African Americans and law enforcement officers. And I say that because these encounters run the gamut from understandably and totally justified to there's no way that can be justified and everything in between. I think for the people who are keeping score on this, they are not separating justified from unjustified every time there is another deadly encounter between an African-American and a law enforcement officer in this country. It adds to the tote board. It turns the temperature up on the, getting hotter, starting to simmer pot, right? And we're not going to get into some of the aspects of this because we've done at least one, and I think we've done two programs on this not that long ago. I mean, on the free feed somewhere, I think. So rather than get into the same stuff in depth again, there are some different angles here I thought we might play with for just a minute. I don't want to go into this too deeply, but, I'm a long-winded guy, so there are no promises. But just to bring up one point that we had brought up in the earlier discussions about this, it seems to me that in order to figure out what the heck we have going on here, you need to figure it's one of two things happening, as we said in an earlier show. Either this is pretty standard behavior that's been going on for a very long time. I mean, black folks have been complaining forever about heavy-handed police tactics. I was taking phone calls on the assignment desk in the late 80s, early 90s, and we were getting lots of calls about that. And so maybe this long, ongoing, situation has been more publicized now because we have all these camera phones and we have the surveillance video and all that stuff. So that's one possibility. And if that is what it is, you would go about fixing it or improving the situation, one way. If, on the other hand, this is something that's changed with law enforcement, and I've heard people making the cases about the growing militarization of the police force, or as some retired officers pointed out to me, they say it's really just a change in training, and it's more of it's really like a different lean, right? Before they leaned maybe towards crisis de-escalation, now they lean more towards situation control. But situation control often means making sure that the number one concern is the officer's well-being, and that might entail all sorts of things that look heavy-handed, like tasers and swarming and all kinds of other things. Now, one thing I like to point out, and I think it's legitimate to point out because I also think this goes into the question of solving the problem, and that's, that you're going to get a percentage of these things happening. When you have hundreds of thousands of police officers in a country, it only takes, a small percentage, 0.01, fill in the blank, I don't know what it is, for that to still be a lot of incidents. And if they're getting caught on camera more than they used to, we might be getting an appearance of something that is not quite accurate. I don't know. I simply know that there is a growing sense of outrage and a pot that is simmering about this. How many more of these encounters do you think we can have before something bad happens? I was thinking about this angle. History is not a predictor of the future. And you all know this, right? I mean, this is a pretty simple thing to understand. There are so many variables and so many things that can happen. It's not a good predictor of the future. But sometimes you can say things like, if current trends continue, we can reasonably assume X, right? And of course, the wild card is the current trends may not continue. But I want you to imagine something for a minute. I want you to imagine that in the next year, we have 5 more of these upsetting incidents between law enforcement officers and African Americans, or 10 more, or 15 more. Find a number where you think if you get that many more in the near future, and near future, you know, that could be unpredictable too. It might be over the next 5 years. The thing is that there's nothing going on that would reasonably cause you to assume that trends on this were going to change, right? Are deadly encounters between African Americans and law enforcement officers around the country going to stop? But we don't even know why they're happening or if they've always been happening. So how are they going to stop? So if it's a relative inevitability at this point that these things are going to continue, and if these things are starting to add up like straws on a camel's back, at what point do you reach a moment where something bad happens? And let's define something bad for a minute. People think that the situation in Ferguson, Missouri was bad, or the situation in Baltimore was bad. But what if you had that going on in multiple cities at the same time? You know, we have a very difficult time comparing things. I mean, if you had 5 Ferguson, Missouris going on at once, you would begin to understand what they understood in the late 60s and early 70s. Just how, you know, really out of control this can get when things heat up to a certain point. When Martin Luther King was assassinated, a lot of cities in the U.S. were burning and rioting, and it was bad. Imagine today's modern media with that sort of a spectacle to play with. And so this is the angle I wanted to get into for just a second on the Baltimore/Ferguson riots and all this kind of stuff. It's an interesting sort of perverse dynamic. Nobody's fault. Just sort of arises for totally understandable reasons. But I want to run it past your brain for a second and see if we can't start to see a future here. And then, if you can start to see a future here, could you do anything to head it off before you get there? Or are human beings, by the very way we're designed, almost incapable of warding off these things unless we're shown we have to do it? I'll give you an example of what I mean. Let's say you are a person very tied to a cause, emotionally or angrily or desperately, and you can fill in the blank for your cause, okay? It can be the kinds of causes we see here, you know, Black Lives Matter, or maybe it could be Second Amendment rights. Maybe it could be, you know, how you feel about, you know, the freedom from spying. I mean, fill in the blank, whatever, you know, animal rights, whatever's important to you, right? And you organize a protest. And these are difficult things to do. Any of you out there have ever tried to do this, you know. I mean, my goodness, try getting 80,000 people out somewhere. Get the permits. Make sure it doesn't go wrong. Get them all there at the same time. I mean, it's the publicity. It's a huge amount of work, right? Huge amount of work. And you'll be lucky to pull it off. And if you get 80,000 people out, that's a big protest by today's standards. That's a big stadium full of people. Think about how many bathrooms and food and all the things, you know, 80,000 people need. Now imagine trying to keep 80,000 potentially angry people all behaving and everything. And then if you do it well, if you do it poorly, you'll get no publicity. If you do it well, you'll get some a little newspaper coverage that day, maybe. The organizers can make a statement to the press. The TV cameras might show up for the day. And then the next day, maybe a little follow-up story on the cleanup after the big protest, and then you're done. All that for that. Now, look at the perverse incentive here, though. What if some of those 80,000 people that are difficult to control start breaking windows, go into a few shops and take stuff, punch a cop in the face, I mean, whatever it might be? What do you think's going to happen then? Well, the news media is going to show up, first of all, aren't they? I mean, look at this from a CNN or a Fox News' standpoint, right? You're going to cover a protest on something, and that's going to, you know, people are going to go, oh, very interesting, a protest. Or you're going to cover something where you can put up a graphic that says, Baltimore burning, or whatever. right? Where you can put reporters down at the scene, where you can get the helicopters out. In other words, for an entity that exists in the if it bleeds, it leads mentality, a riot, for example, is a much more coverable event. I used to be an assignment editor, folks. Let me tell you, we cover riots. Protests are iffy, and even if you cover them, you don't cover them for long. CNN will cover a riot, then they'll cover the post thing of the riot, then, I mean, it'll just be over and over. They'll do a special thing at the end of the week. Politicians will comment on it. Commentators will write things in the newspaper. People will discuss, what's this all about? And they'll have arguments between the left and the right, and, you know, who's... Folks, if you're hoping to get a message out to the American people and start a national debate, where are all the incentives lined up for you? Protest or riot? You know the whole thing is totally screwed up when the incentives line up, you know, in a way that just says, listen, if a few people broke some windows and started stealing stuff at our protest, we'd get a lot more coverage. That's perverse. We don't want to encourage people to riot. But that's when people get attention. You know, in the 1960s, we love to focus on the Civil Rights Revolution and the peaceful marches and Martin Luther King and nonviolence and all that stuff. And all that was very important. But you would be remiss if you forgot that this was really a sort of two-fisted assault on inequality back in the 1960s and early 1970s. And by two-fisted, I mean the peaceful marchers who sat there and got attacked by dogs and knocked down by water cannons and all this kind of stuff. But on the other side, the people like the Black Panthers taking firearms. Can you even imagine this today, Ben? Taking firearms into a state building, you know, together, all coming in armed, defending their Second Amendment rights, by the way. Or the riots. Go look at the statistics on the riots, ladies and gentlemen, in the 1960s, early 1970s. We were having big, nasty riots and multiple riots at the same time. Martin Luther King dies, and you have multiple riots all over the place. Imagine CNN would have to be using a split screen. Now we go to Atlanta. Now we go to Detroit, live from Houston. I mean, you'd just be going back and forth. And we're going to take a very quick break here, but we are getting rid of some of our ads today to give you wall-to-wall coverage. Meanwhile, the ads they are showing you are going for 10 times the price. I guess what I'm saying, folks, is if I'm running CNN, I'm wall-to-wall covering that riot, too, because my ratings are going to skyrocket. They're doing exactly what a news organization would do based on the incentives. But what are the incentives on the rioters or the peaceful protesters who see that, you know, my goodness, we hardly get any coverage after all this work, but those people go and do something destructive, and now the cause gets addressed or attention? Because in the 1960s, the president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, was having whole commissions and investigations into looking into why people were upset enough to riot and all these things. In other words, yes, Martin Luther King marching was all well and good, but it was when we had all these riots and we don't want to have any more that we sit down and say, my goodness, what can we address here to make sure we have no more riots? Sometimes it's easy to blow off a few protests. Riots are harder to shake off. But what kind of dynamic is that? What are you saying if you are the status quo, fill in the blank for what you think that might be, if you don't address these problems until somebody breaks something? Which gets me to, you know, thinking about the best way maybe to address something. If we wanted to be wise about anything, right? And I'm not saying we do. We're human beings, and that's not our default position, okay? Especially when we're talking about doing it in large groups. Easier for you to be wise by yourself or your neighbor to be wise. Get us into a large group, and we get a little mobbish at that point, and mobs are very rarely wise. Nonetheless, in this case, if you wanted to think ahead, and if you wanted to say, listen, if current trends continue and African Americans continue to have these fatal, sometimes justified, sometimes not justified encounters with law enforcement officers, eventually you're going to reach a point where things blow up. Now, they're not going to get 1960s standards bad. That's one of the worst two or three eras in the country for unrest. It's not going to get that bad, but we're not ready for that bad. If we had five Fergusons going on at the same time in five different U.S. cities, that's freak out time by our current standards. What would we do after that? First of all, the news coverage, I mean, it would saturate everything. It's all we would talk about. It would be wall to wall. I mean, you know, it'd be huge. Everyone would be talking about it. There would be calls to do something. You probably would have a two-fisted sort of an approach, right? We're going to crack down on this sort of lawlessness on one hand, but on the other hand, this thing that says, listen, if these kinds of conditions or these sorts of circumstances continue, we can expect more of these. The inner city poverty, the lack of jobs, or you might also say, these deadly encounters between law enforcement officers and minorities, right? What can we do to at least address this, at least study it and figure out what's going on? By the way, as a sort of a side note, anyone else out there a little surprised that one of the things that we found out with these recent incidents is that they really don't keep tabs on the statistics? Well, in some places, but most places, the government doesn't know how many of these kinds of encounters occur because the record keeping is haphazard at best. So in any case, if you were the government, you might just want to study it. How about studying that problem we talked about earlier? Is this something that's always happened with a small percentage of law enforcement officers? Or is this something that's relatively new? I mean, all these things could be on the table if we cared enough, right? And we would care enough when cities started burning. What if we just pretended that this course that, you know, if current trends continue, we're heading towards, what if we just jumped ahead to after the 5 or 6 or 7 simultaneous riots and said, if we're going to get there eventually and we're going to be forced to address it, let's address it now. Let's make sure current trends don't continue. If we're waiting till the water boils over to figure out a way to lower the temperature, why not lower the temperature now when we're at a vigorous simmer instead? As I said, that would be an attempt to preempt nastiness that the human, you know, mentality, especially if it's going to cost money and energy and time and all that stuff, the mentality is usually to wait. Nonetheless, I think you people are all smart enough to see that if this sort of stuff continues, people will just get angrier. That's the current trend. And then something else will happen and we will get there and then address it. Nonetheless, that's the part I wanted to get into about, shall we call it preemptive riot control? And the part that was most interesting to me is this is the most perverse dynamic you've ever seen, isn't it? Do what we suggest you do, go through all the trouble and do the peaceful protest, and nobody's really going to notice, but do what we tell you not to do that nobody wants you to do that actually hurts the very communities these folks are protesting in. Oh, and you might be rewarded with a lot of airtime, your cause being debated, and maybe even a little legislative action. That's perverse. In any case, I think when these things happen, let's understand why. Another subject I wanted to get into, and this is weird, and I'm not going to get into too much of it, but it's, you know, it warms the cockles of my independent heart, shall we say it that way? And it's a very strange thing. In the last program, which seems like it was about 10 years ago, we talked about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and some of these other trade deals, and that's actually very big in the news right now, but it's sort of an up-in-the-air thing. I wouldn't want to delve into it, because by the time you get this show, it may have changed. But the interesting part about it is how it has sort of changed who's on what side amongst the various government officials. In other words, the president is lining up mostly with Republicans in pushing this bill, and it's mostly Democrats that are against him. And he has been, and I have a bunch of stories on this, I'm not even going to go there, but he's been actually sort of taking pot shots at his own party and calling them names. I mean, it's relatively unprecedented, especially when you have to work with those people again. Nonetheless, what's fascinating is I go to a lot of different news sites, as you probably understand. And by the way, I'm going to start using some that have usually been on my don't use list because I used to think of them as more tabloid. But now you're getting some decent stories out of some of these places occasionally. And sites that I used to think were pretty good have descended into tabloidism and are not useful anymore. So don't be surprised if I start throwing a few different sources out here because they've hired some interesting writers. But nonetheless, in this case, I was on a bunch of these conservative websites, and of course, you know I love the comment section underneath the story where the readers can comment and give feedback. And it was one of those sites where generally the feedback is about how Obama's born in Africa, and he's trying to take down the country, and liberals are destroying the earth, and, you know, whatever it might be. And on this Trade-Pacific Partnership thing, and the story was about the Democrats opposing President Obama and the Republicans, and they were, I mean, comment after comment after comment was saying, I never thought, that's the big line, I never thought I'd say this, but, and then they went on to praise the Democrats and to slam the GOP people that were lining up with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and of course, you know, slam the president too. Things weren't that different. But to me, you know, as I've always said, folks, we as the American people, and, you know, I'm starting to think this is a more global phenomenon. The more I watch what happens in Washington, D.C., almost like a dropping a big stone in water, and you watch the wave of what we're doing then reach foreign shores, and you see, for example, Britain is a wonderful example of a country you see literally having these waves of American security changes sweep over them too, and in some ways they seem ahead of where we are even, so maybe this applies to all of us. But we're all kind of in this together. And one of the things that prevents us from addressing the biggest problems is that we are divided in the oldest play in military manuals anywhere, the divide and conquer idea. And they divide us into left and right and conservative and liberal. And there are divisions, folks. There are different views of how you think society should be organized. I mean, really basic bedrock things. But nobody I've ever found is pro-corruption. Nobody I've ever found thinks that the government, well, that I take that back. Most people, I have found a few people, most people don't think that the people should basically be almost a symbolic voice or that the people should be able to control policy at the margins, but the main core policy is really out of their hands. Try changing U.S. foreign policy, right? There are very few people you will run into that if you say, should the American people be allowed to change U.S. foreign policy, who will say, oh, no, no, the American people shouldn't be allowed to do that. Good luck finding those people. Even the ones who believe it won't say it because it's really, you know, disconcerting and unpopular to say that. But it's true. How could you get that power back? Well, it would require Republicans and Democrats and liberals and conservatives and all these weird independent Martian people like me in between understanding that we all have a shared interest in a clean system. Lawrence Lessig, I think, makes a very good point in his book Republic Lost, which, by the way, is free on the internet now, and you can check it out, where he goes and says, you know, how corruption is hurting liberal ideas is one section. But then he's got another section on how the corruption is hurting conservative causes. And he's trying to do the same thing, which is to point out that no matter what you think, a corrupt system isn't going to give it to you. You've got to fix the structure before things can work within the structure. And reading those comments at the end of that, you know, article was heartwarming because you start to tell yourself that people are so entrenched in their ideas that even if the other side adopted their entire platform, they'd still be forced to say, you know, effing Democrats or fascist Republicans, you know, wouldn't even care. It's a totem, as they say in psychology, when you learn in Psychology 101 about totems and these party labels are sometimes so connected to people's self-image of themselves that it's really sort of divorced from the actual policy questions, right? I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican, and this is how I see myself, and this is how I project myself to others. And if the other political party actually adopted the platform of my political party, I still probably couldn't support them because, well, I'm not that party, right? I'm not that kind of guy. That's not who I am. Everyone knows I'm a blank. So I think seeing those comments at the end of those very conservative news stories, it warmed the cockles of my Martian independent heart, maybe. I think I keep a little tote board in my head of things that, you know, are evidence that people can work together and we can create some kind of unity, which is the only way we're going to fix a bunch of these problems. And I also keep sort of a tote board of evidence in my head that we can't. And so this is one I can put in the, hey, it can happen side of the ledger and provide a little good news for a program that doesn't always push the good news out there. The last thing I wanted to talk about is the original topic of the program. It's funny how it can stray and go into other things, but I am long-winded. We all know that. And I had to wrestle a little bit with this because it's, as every podcaster who's done a bunch of shows knows, we podcasters are trying to figure out sort of the rules of doing this. And as you get to a lot of episodes, which a bunch of podcasters are now, there are questions that come up, questions that have been solved in commercial radio already about how often you bring up the same things and go back. I mean, I've got listeners who've been listening for 6 years, do not want to hear things that I bring up all the time. I have people that started with us 3 shows ago who've never heard bedrock things that are part of this program. So it's very hard to figure out, you know, how to pivot on that. So even when I talk about things that I consider to be very important, we always try to find, if we can, little different ways of approaching it. And as I was thinking about this topic, there's a bunch of stories, is what it boils down to, in the recent news. Well, the news since the last program we did. That might not necessarily even consist of just recent news anymore. But there's a bunch of these stories, and I thought to myself, you know, if you wanted to, you could break each one of these problems or issues down to the same point that I want to make the overall sort of umbrella issue of this segment of this show. And I read a Lou Reed story the other day that I'd read a long time ago, but once I read it, I went, bingo. That's kind of the analogy for this situation. Now, disclaimer before I tell this story, this happened in the late 1950s or early 1960s. So things might have been different then. In fact, Lou Reed and his family may have gone to the worst electroshock therapist that ever existed. I don't know what it's like now. I'm just repeating what I read. Lou Reed says when he was like a late teenager, his parents took him to somebody for some sort of mental health needs, and he was prescribed electroshock therapy to deal with it. Lou Reed, by the way, former lead singer of the Velvet Underground, sort of a rock and roll artist, legend, recently passed away. Very interesting guy. But he tells this story, and he says the worst part of having the electroshock therapy was that it erased your short-term memory. And you couldn't read a book anymore, he said, because by the time you get to page 15, you can't remember what you read on page 1 or 2 or anything like that. Imagine how people would be if they all had this same sort of situation Lou Reed had going on after he went to that electroshock therapy. There's a quote, and it's a knockoff of a Cicero original, the ancient Roman orator, but it's on the library at the University of Colorado. And it says, and I'm going to, you know, this should be burned into my brain. I'll misquote it anyway. It says, I think it says who, but I'm going to make it more clear by saying, he who knows only his own time remains always a child. And that's a little like what you are if you don't have very much of a past to draw on when you're weighing decisions, right? You're like a child. You're like a political child if you don't remember what went on politically 5 years ago. Or 7 or 8 years ago. I mean, imagine you're a 16-year-old, and we have quite a few of them listening to this program. How far back does your political memory go? Now, you can go and read books, as, you know, my goodness, and please do, but it's still not the same as living through a time period as an informed person, we'll put that disclaimer in there, day to day, and the amount of detail you are able to suck up and store in your memory banks. Now, of course, the purpose for this is the same purpose that you get if you walk into some office and somebody tries to become your financial advisor. Some of you have them, some of you don't, but if you don't, here's what happens. You walk in and they start showing you charts. And the charts will say things like 1975, and you'll see a graph, and 1982, and you know, all these different things. Where what they're trying to show you is how the stock market has performed in the past. And then they will give you the famous disclaimer. Of course, past performance is no guarantee of future results. That's a little what history is good for as a predictive tool, because anybody who thinks history predicts the future, they're just wrong. There are thousands of variables. All kinds of things can happen. I mean, you know, if you tried to make a living gambling on that sort of a process, you might be in trouble. But sometimes you can see where trends are going, like we said earlier in the program. And because of that, you can begin to say, well, if current trends continue, past performance indicates this is what will happen. Most people unconsciously start doing that in life. You put your hand on the stove, you get burned, you know, because you remember that past performance indicates if I put my hand on the stove, I will get burned. Very few people keep putting their hand on the stove, although we all probably know people, friends, loved ones, family members who seem to be incapable of learning from their mistakes, right? You've probably we're all very close to people like that. It's not an uncommon human situation, but it's like watching a train wreck in slow motion, isn't it, when you're watching from the sidelines? And you think to yourself, you know, I can't tell you how often I think to myself, it's a rookie mistake. They'll do something and I'll think to myself, okay, that's something you do when you're 18. Or when you're 19, or when you're 20 and you don't know any better, but by the time you're 40, you've made that mistake a few times. I think we can all understand how dangerous not being able to learn from your mistakes can be for an individual. But how is it for individuals in a nation when taken as a whole collectively? What if we have an electorate who can't learn from their mistakes? Or maybe a better way to put it is has no memory of them, like Lou Reed being, you know, electrotherapied, right? I mean, many times we've used the analogy from the Peanuts comic strip with Charlie Brown and Lucy and the football. And I'm sorry if you don't know this. It's a dumb analogy if people don't know it. But it's always the same, right? Lucy always pulls the football away from Charlie Brown at the last minute when he's trying to kick it, and he ends up on his back. So every time Lucy wants to convince him again to do it, she has to give him a more sophisticated argument because he remembers last time and the time before and the time before that you pulled it away. But in order to make the case I'm trying to make today, you have to imagine that that's a bad analogy because Charlie Brown remembers past performance. Our electorate, in many of the stories I want to just sort of use this as a lens to view through, show that the electorate doesn't even remember that Lucy pulled the football away last time. They've had electroshock therapy from the 1950s, and they can't remember what the book said on page one. When they encounter somebody, for example, on CNN or Fox News or one of these things who's General so-and-so, U.S. Army retired, longtime contributor to CNN or longtime contributor to Fox News or whatever, who's telling us about the situation in Iran and who says, you know, at some point we're gonna have to go in, you know, and then the announcer says, expert advice from blah, blah, blah from the U.S. military retired or whatever. They don't tell you what this guy's track record is. There were several good stories in the last couple of weeks bringing up a point that's periodically raised, by the way. Periodically, people will say, why the hell do we have to keep listening to all these people, these pundits, these military retired people? I mean, why are the people that are wrong in past performance continually brought back to advise us on the next situation? If this were a private, competitive, outside the public sector industry, it's hard to imagine that people with such bad track records would still be in business. Now, if you cared that the public doesn't know, I mean, you know, imagine the 16-year-old listening to the program now. If General so-and-so, who was wrong about Afghanistan and wrong about Iraq, or this particular neoconservative magazine owner was, and he gets up there and says what we need to do about Iran— it's okay that you don't know. You're 16. When this guy was making his incorrect predictions about being welcomed with flowers when we went into Iraq, you were a toddler at best. You can be forgiven for that. He can be your first mistake. You can say, God, I got hoodwinked into going to Iran because I listened to William Crystal. You didn't know. But if you're 40, there's no excuse for this. Now, if CNN or Fox or any of these media outlets wanted the 16-year-old and the people who are older and don't remember to know the track record, they could tell you. They could put a graphic up there. I mean, imagine it's Las Vegas, and these are Las Vegas betting, you know, advisors. I got the lock of the week. Here's what you need. You got to go with Miami minus four, you know, if Marino plays. But you want to see the record, right? Jimmy the Greek was 0-17 last week, but I got a lock of the week, right? You're going to take that into account, are you? You might say, well, he's Jimmy the Greek. He's great. He's got a trick, you know. But listen, he's 0-17 last week. I'm going to weigh my odds. If you don't know General so-and-so or Pundit so-and-so, and you don't know that they're 0-2 on major foreign policy advice in the last, you know, decade and a half, you can't weigh that. I mean, if you go down the street and some swindler, not to compare these people to swindlers, they're more like people who try to get your support for policies that are probably not in your interest. So there's a little bit of find the ball under the paper cup, you know, sleight of hand going on here. But if you've never run into that person before and they fool you, you can be forgiven. Where it gets perverse, that's going to be my word of the day, isn't it, Ben, for the show? The whole thing is perverse to me today. But it gets perverse when the guy who's, or woman, there are some good women, hide the ball under the paper cup players too, when they fooled you last week, now getting fooled again is not so defensible. And if they fooled you the week before that too, it gets to be something where you wonder if you maybe need, you know, a little parental authority or ward of the state or something like that to take care of you because you're not making solid decisions. Many times we talk about things on this program, little teeny tweaks that might help create a more informed electorate. If anybody cared to do that, by the way. If the media wanted to, and we've said this before, they should show you on a graphic next to the name of every politician in Washington, D.C., they show you their top 10 campaign contributors. Put it right up there every time. Bingo. You just inform the public in a way that is so much greater than the way you're informing them now. You know, you've upped your relevance rating 20% in my mind right there. Can we quantify that, Ben? And I think you find the same sort of benefit if, like the graph that your financial advisor shows you over the years, and this is past performance, these people had to, you know, live with their results as opposed to getting to wipe the slate clean every time they're going to tell you what to do. And it starts off with those advisors who'll say, you know, something about Iraq or Iran. But those are people trying to convert the public. We have the same problem going on when it comes to the people who have to convince the people who can order these things to happen. For example, the president or the House of Representatives or whatever, trying to make sense of what the intelligence services tell them and what their track record is historically. I thought about this a lot. Came up with one of my weird Dan Carlin theories and within 5 minutes realized the tragic, horrible side effects that it would have caused. But for 5 minutes was having a great time with the idea. So I'll run it past you in a second and you can have, well, some of you will see right away, oh, that's a dumb idea. But some of you can play for 5 minutes like I did before you figure it out. But I was thinking about how, if you're the president of the United States, how hard it is to take past performance into account, right? I mean, imagine you're Barack Obama, but you could be George W. Bush in the last election. What was the number one excuse, by the way, that every single Congress critter and president and vice president said, you know, it was the reason that they should basically be forgiven for being wrong about Iraq? And when I say wrong, I mean wrong about this idea that we could go in there, create a functioning, you know, democracy in that region that was respectful of human rights. It could be a beacon to the whole, you know, the beginning of the domino effect when democracy topples the dictatorships of the Middle East and all is hunky-dory and democracies never go to war with each other. That idea. The people that are wrong about this simply say, well, you know, everybody believed it. The intelligence said. Blame the intelligence, right? If the intelligence provided is wrong, and that becomes a cover that everybody can hide beneath, what happens when it happens again? In other words, we have a system and a dynamic in place right now where it's almost impossible to imagine confronting the track record of these agencies that are the eyes and the ears of the U.S. government. These are your senses as a country, right? You can't really very easily say to them, the last thing you saw and the time before that, they were mirages. You weren't really seeing what you thought you saw. And they're saying, yes, but I see a nuclear weapon in the distance this time. You know how hard it is for a president to turn around and go, you know, I don't believe you. Sorry, it's not a nuclear weapon. It's another mirage. And if it's a nuclear weapon, well, I mean, those stakes are the kind that not just politicians, but most people would say, listen, let's be on the safe side here. Probably is a mirage, but I don't want to risk it. I have some sympathy for that. And if you go and read presidential memoirs, there are several presidents that had real issues with the kind of intelligence they were getting. In fact, you know, there's a whole school of thought, and this goes back to the way that bureaucracies used to control kings and emperors and those kind of people. It's a famous technique where you just provide, you know, the kind of information to the leader that you want to. And by only showing them the sorts of things you want them to see, you can often sort of push them to the sorts of decisions you want. I read a great book called, I think it was Double Government. I talked about it on an earlier show a couple shows ago. That did the best job I've ever seen from a very, very centrist perspective of explaining, you know, how the government becomes immune to change from people like us. And they even quote President Obama talking about the sort of choices that the military and intelligence bureaucracy brings to him. And it's famously one horrible choice, one terrible, you know, it's two bad choices and one good choice every time. That's a good way to put it. And so basically the way that they frame it, they get you to choose what they want you to choose. That's an old technique, goes back to controlling, as I said, even absolute rulers in earlier time periods. But if you are, for example, the president or the Congress, and you got hoodwinked about yellow cake and nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction with Saddam Hussein, and those same people come to you and say,
In 2 weeks, Iran's going to have a nuclear weapon, and they have this missile to put it on, and you better act now. What do you do? Think of how hard it is to defy that if you turn out to be wrong. At the same time, our intelligence services, our eyes and ears, our national senses when it comes to that stuff misses a lot of big events and is wrong a lot of the time. How do you take that into account and weigh that? So here's a case where we might know about past mistakes, but we're in a situation where you're not really allowed to take them into account. You don't have another good choice, right? If you don't like what the CIA is telling you and you're not sure it's right, what can you do about that? Well, you've got another government agency. You could say, well, let's call the NSA and let's try to confirm that information that the CIA had, right? Or you can call another intelligence agency. Let's call Mossad and see if they can confirm this information. But I thought, you know, and this is obviously a sign that I'm raised in a capitalist system that pushes the value of competition as a efficiency increaser and all these kinds of things, right? Sort of a Darwinian approach to getting a better outcome. And I was imagining an intelligence agency that was like a private version of the CIA or the NSA or what have you, something that the government could bring in as a second voice in these kinds of situations, right? The sort of company that if they had the track record that our intelligence services have would be out of business a long time ago. The only reason that you have, you know, intelligence.com LLC, for lack of a better name, is because they've been so good at predicting, you know, past events, right? I know somebody's going to say something, well, Dan, this is what Stratfor is. It's not. Trust me. I read enough of that Stratfor stuff to know that, let's just say I'm not sure it's much of an improvement over the way the public government agencies are doing with predicting and whatnot. I'm talking about an agency that was just really good, right? Sees the fall of the Soviet Union, doesn't miss that. Sees the Russian response in Ukraine. Not only sees the 9/11 attacks, but manages to get the attention of the president and tell him in advance, knows we were going to get bogged down and have a bad outcome in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Imagine instead of being 0-2, 0-3, 0-4, they're 5-1. Jimmy the Greek is 0-17 the previous season. These guys are 17-2. Who are you going to pick to go with, right? That was my 5 minutes of fun before I started thinking of the incredible downsides of having an agency in the private sector that was trying to compete with our intelligence agencies for knowing about things, right? Not bad enough being spied on by all your public agencies that exist through your tax dollars. Now you can get spied upon also by a private one that, you know, if they really spy on you well, we'll be able to give a dividend to the shareholders this time around. I mean, so I caught it before you guys got a chance to. Nonetheless, I enjoyed the idea of a president or a Congress, one, having somewhere else to turn to. Let's get a second opinion, right? And by doing so, getting a chance to learn from the mistakes of past performance, I would suggest that that's another situation where our politicians have frightfully limited options, because you'd have to be Eisenhower or Nixon. Kennedy famously had run-ins with those people. You really have to stand up to them, and it's hard to do because you realize, gosh, you know, they may be wrong about this being welcomed with flowers thing if I go into Iraq. At the same time, if they're right about these weapons of mass destruction, what's history going to think of me if I'm the guy that lets Saddam Hussein nuke Israel? When the stakes are that high, you don't have to be a relatively spineless Congress critter to decide to go that route. There's brave, intelligent, cynical, patriotic people that might weigh their odds and choose that way too, just to be safe. Now, I had a couple other issues that I thought really reflected this idea of having too short of a memory and not learning from our mistakes. Since we're talking about intelligence, I want to take that to drones for a second. Now, many shows ago, we pointed out the obvious problem with our drone policy in this country. And, you know, it was easy to do because it's something that the United States continually does. And once again, you would think we would learn from our mistakes, right? But for example, when we were the only country, when we held a monopoly on atomic weapons, we were relatively freewheeling about them. It wasn't that we used them all the time, but we were ready to whip out the nuclear weapon card, well, it was an atomic weapon at the time, at any time. You go back and you read the history. Eh, we're thinking a few bombs right over here and this Chinese, you know, river incursion over near North Korea, that's over with. You know, I mean, really ready to just bring out the atomic weapons as needed in bundles. And then as soon as someone else got them, we were like, wait a minute, there should be some rules about these kinds of weapons. And, you know, going to have to think about, these are different than any other kind of weapon, you know. And so all of a sudden, the hubris of thinking that, listen, we don't even have to, you know, we're the only ones with them. What are they going to do? Well, that's not a situation that's going to last forever. One would think you could be forgiven for that. As we said, if it's your first train wreck and you're 17 years old, that's called life experience. If you're 40 years old and you've wrecked this train many times before, it becomes less forgivable. So we fast forward to drones. We said lots and lots and lots of shows ago, years ago, that treating drones the way we do will come back to bite us because we may be the only one using them at the moment, but that's a situation that's temporary. And what's more, you knew it was temporary, not because China was going to have to, you know, do research for 20 years to perfect this technology, but because our same government was approving these same companies who helped build our drones, selling those drones to the foreign countries that would then be using drones by whatever rules we were establishing when we were the only ones using drones. And I said at the time, imagine any other country using these the way we do. We will lose our minds if somebody does what we're doing in other countries to us. Lose our minds. Let me play with this scenario for you a minute. Imagine China has their own version of Osama bin Laden and a 9/11 attack, right? They have issues in Western China. Those are Islamic areas. They have problems with terrorism. Imagine that someone crops up there that manages to kill, let's put it on a Chinese scale, the Chinese population numbers. I mean, whenever you see anything in China, the numbers are always so huge. I don't know that the Chinese would be as moved by small numbers as we are, but what if 15,000 or 20,000 Chinese civilians were killed in a terror attack over there, and the Chinese, you know, went after their Osama bin Laden, as we would ours, finds him in a community in Minneapolis, Minnesota, sends a drone over there, and blows him up. And kills 12 people in the blast radius who are innocent Americans. Now, I imagine our government would be okay with the Chinese terminating a person like that because if they didn't, we probably would. We can't have those kind of dangerous people running around, especially not in Minneapolis. But if the Chinese used a weapon that killed 12 innocent Americans while they took out their bad target in the United States, what do you think we would do? What are the rules for using drones? Well, we haven't had any. The rule has been up till now, we use drones any damn way we think we have to use drones, right? What's going to happen when these other countries start using them? And the first thing they say is, well, as we understand it, the rules are that we can use these things any damn way we want to, right? Isn't that the rule right now, guys? It is. So the country acts as though it's been on Lou Reed's 1959 or whatever it is, electroshock therapy, when we continually, you know, and maybe I'll get to something in a second which suggests another way of looking at this, but continually can't seem to learn that if we use these weapons in ways we won't want them to be used when other people have them, we will create rules that we don't like later, right? Be nice if we could learn from that. As I said, at the end of this, I want to throw out a counter theory about maybe why some of these elites out there, for lack of a better word, why they aren't learning, because they have a much better idea of past performance than we do. But there's a reason that they might not be learning. That's a theory we could run with. Nonetheless, a couple more things that I think are really impacted by this inability to remember, you know, politically what happened a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. How about these trade deals? The things we talked about in the very last episode, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and all that. Since that show, by the way, a lot's been happening on that front, but it's a quickly moving situation. If we had dealt with any detail of that in today's show, I think it would be outdated by the time you got it. Nonetheless, there are some interesting, funny things about this that revolve around the idea of people having short memories. The president's people have come out and made an interesting statement about this trade deal. they say that we know that past trade deals have not lived up to the promises. Now, that's a fascinating thing for them to say, because what that shows is that enough people have brought up and publicized past performance that the administration didn't just have to address it, they had to admit it. It's one thing to say, hey, wait a minute, let me take on that point because NAFTA's doing more good than you think, or whatever. They didn't say that. They said, we understand, it didn't live up to the hype. But then they said, but this one will, but it's secret and you can't read it, so trust me, I'd never sign anything that wouldn't help the American people, right? I mean, this is the kind of thing where if you're the electorate, you need to say to yourself, look, I might believe you. I'm not saying that, you know, just because past performance didn't live up to the promises that I'm not going to believe you, but I am going to take into account that past performance didn't live up to the promises. Now the scales tip a little bit more on the, okay, I'm going to be very careful with this swindler or this guy playing three-card Monty or hiding the ball under the paper cup. I'm going to be a little bit on guard because of past performance, right? And then when they say, well, it's secret and you can't see it, okay, I'm going to be a little bit more on guard due to past performance. In other words, this is how you account for the past. I mean, if you burned yourself on that stove, the next time you see the stove, you're going to approach the stove a little more cautiously. If the electorate could learn as a mass, and if the media made it in their interest, you know, to try to teach them, show them past performance, get on people who were, you know, for and against these earlier trade deals that, as the Obama administration said, didn't live up to the promises, and get them on the television to make them answer that. I mean, one of the things that has always driven me crazy is that we never call these people onto the carpet when they're wrong, right? I had talked about the generals earlier, but, you know, if you go back, and it's on YouTube, you can find some of the debates that happened over NAFTA. And when NAFTA happened, I was in my first stint on the radio. Congressman Peter DeFazio here in Oregon had recently gone to Congress, and he was against that, and I was against it, and almost nobody else knew what it was. And so we would do show after show until, you know, as usual, I was fighting with the station consultants and all those people, because we're talking about something nobody cares about. But at the time, you could see what was going to happen. And when Ross Perot did a very public campaign to try to tell people what was going to happen. Perot, by the way, a multi-billionaire, business owner, the whole thing. And he was going around explaining what NAFTA was going to mean for American workers. And he would go on shows, and sometimes he would be opposed by the vice president of the United States at that time, who was actively pushing this NAFTA idea. That would be Al Gore. And go back and watch these conversations between Al Gore and billionaire Ross Perot, where Al Gore, and I mean condescendingly and almost mockingly, tries to give a lesson to billionaire Ross Perot on economics and capitalism and jobs and businesses. You're almost embarrassed for him. Then go watch the Sir James Goldsmith, and we've talked about him before, the late Sir James Goldsmith. Go watch him debate a Clinton administration economics official on this same thing, right? Billionaire, famous capitalist Sir James Goldsmith taking the Ross Perot line that you're going to be sorry with GATT. You're going to be sorry. And the administration, you know, this is really an academic who teaches, saying, no, you're totally wrong about all this, Mr. Goldsmith. Now, I believe that the person who was on with Sir James Goldsmith teaches economics at Berkeley at the moment. I wonder if they're admitting to being wrong about this whole NAFTA thing. I've never heard, has Gore, you know, dialed that back? I mean, the point is that here you had people who were right and people who were wrong, and yet the people who were wrong are still teaching this subject, you know, at universities around the country. Our inability to call people to the carpet. I mean, why doesn't she have to have an 0-2? Sort of rating under her name, you know, so-and-so is teaching economics at Berkeley. You should know, though, that she's 0-2 on major economic trade deal predictions. Once again, I mean, isn't that funny, Ben, that this would be something that might be more taken into account by gamblers in Las Vegas than voters in an electorate? Another one of those subjects, and again, I thought about it last week, that could fall into this category of us not learning from our mistakes and not getting any better, is believing politicians. And I can't even believe I'm discussing this. I mean, some of you are rolling your eyes going, really? You're going there? The fact that we still believe politicians is the most disheartening part of watching this electorate and wondering whether or not we can actually handle being the significant voice in the direction of our country. Because that happens so often. You are so often swindled, or you so often touch that hot stove when it comes to politicians not living up to what they tell you they're going to do, that to not learn that, you know, you should almost be institutionalized, really. I mean, to believe campaign promises, to actually have debates about Mitt Romney's plan or Barack Obama's plan or whatever it is, as though that's going to happen. Folks, I mean, if you can't learn that, then we can't fix anything. I mean, in that old financial advisor's line, past performance is no guarantee of future results. Past performance on campaign promises is disastrous. There are no sanctions, by the way. There are no downsides other than maybe the electorate holding you accountable. But guess what? The electorate really doesn't. Go look at the amount of times and the percentage of times that incumbents are reelected. And of course, that's helped by a lot of gaming in the system, just redistricting and all kinds of things to make sure that any advantage we can have for the people that are already there continuing to stay there, we will manage to do. Right? That's always in the best interest of the people who are currently in office. If as a country, we could learn to not trust campaign ads and not trust politicians, we would undercut some of the main avenues of corruption in our society. As we've said to you many times, there's two main things that are corrupting our elected leadership. One is the campaign money that they need to run advertising. And if you watch the advertising, you know it's aimed at political children. You know it's aimed at people that don't know what's going on, because these ads don't work on people who do. It gives you an example of how many people out there don't know what's going on. If they weren't such political children, those ads would not be as effective, and all of a sudden that money's less valuable to the politicians, right? Do you want to sell your soul for this money? Not if the ads aren't going to work. The other side to the corruption is the revolving door between government and private industry, where you can say to somebody, listen, I can't give you any money now. That's illegal. Take care of us on this financial committee now, and there'll be a nice, cushy $750,000 a year job and a lot of stock options waiting for you when you come out. Don't worry. That's a little harder, by the way, to take care of. But once again, if we could have a nice expose on the news showing all the people that have done it, we might start to learn a little bit more about it, start to incorporate that into our memory banks, and then maybe past performance might help us understand future results a little bit better. Now, I wanted to talk about, though, a last possibility that occurred to me on this not learning from our mistakes, and it might have to do with the definition of the word mistake, right? I mean, if you don't consider the same thing to be a mistake, then maybe you learn a completely different lesson from what I consider to be a mistake. Take, for example, something that I have friends from across the political spectrum, there's quite a few of them that have a pretty much corporate view of how the world runs. It runs based on corporate interests and global financial entities and those kinds of things. And what those people will say, it's funny because I don't discount all of this stuff. I just think it's one part of a larger puzzle, but it's interesting. Take someone like Halliburton. And there are, by the way, a ton of companies besides Halliburton that make money off things like deployments to Iraq or Afghanistan. When you look at the amount of stuff and the amount of money that has to be spent to support a power projection operation like what we do in the Middle East, you realize that a ton of companies benefit in huge economic ways when we decide to make a decision, you know, to go into some place. And remember, since most of these are public companies, that also means that their stockholders benefit. In other words, there's a little bit of a trickle-down effect. If Iraq might have been a terrible choice in terms of trying to achieve our foreign policy goals, but there were some side benefits. And if you were Halliburton, you were one of the beneficiaries of it. And if you were Dick Cheney, who was tied to Halliburton at the hip, you're one of the beneficiaries of this. So the question to a guy like that is, how much do you see Iraq as a mistake? It's a mistake if you're an American with no stock in these companies, but it might not have been a mistake to some people. So when you say, why doesn't Dick Cheney learn from his mistakes? Does he consider this a mistake? Or perhaps he thinks of it as a wash. It was a foreign policy wash, but of course the implementation was botched by Obama. But it was an economic plus. So, I mean, it's pretty much, economic gain, political loss. And we can always fix the political loss. And at the same time, we can do so in a way that once again enriches somebody who makes money off us using our troops in a power projection capacity far away from home. I mean, they need to eat, right? Somebody's got to make that food. So maybe the idea of learning from our mistakes requires us to decide, you know, what a mistake is. So I guess, you know, how you view a mistake kind of matters as well. And mistakes may be different in terms of, you know, whether the general public is looking at them or whether specific groups are. I guess the way to put it is not everybody looks at a foreign policy disaster the same way. Might have cost the government and the taxpayers of this country a lot of money for a situation that's probably worse than it would have been had we done nothing. But that money had to go somewhere, and if you were one of the people on the receiving end of it, it might look a whole lot less negative to you. Once again, it gets me thinking about me owning CNN. If you haven't figured this out yet, that's just sort of my fantasy of, you know, if I had something like that, how could I accomplish these goals? And like I said, to be able to throw up the contributors right next to the legislator's name in a graphic. First of all, think that will affect the legislator, trust me. All of a sudden, you know, you've just taken something that's normally in the shadows as far as most Americans are concerned and shined a big bright light on them. To be able to put the track record of these people. I mean, you could have William Crystal up there and you could put his top 10 predictions and right or wrong next to it. I mean, there's a lot of things you could do if what you wanted to do is help the public understand, you know, who you should listen to and why and how to weigh decisions, right? The way you would if you took that couple or those relatives of yours that can't seem to learn from their mistakes and put them in some kind of counseling and said, you know what, let's teach you how to make better decisions. Let's empower you to make better decisions, right? When you see that swindler at the end of the street, let's not pretend like you've never seen him before. How can we help educate the public in a way that makes them better at their job of helping to contribute to the running of this country? Believe me, if they invent smart pills someday, that just might be the easier shortcut. I bet my friend Joe Rogan has some things that if the general public was taking, maybe the electorate's IQ goes up just from some of that stuff. But listen, I mean, having an electorate that doesn't know what's going on is working out for somebody too, right? I mean, there are people out there, I think, who consider it to be a benefit that, as the old line goes, there's a sucker born every minute, especially if those people vote. We've told you about Ting for a long time now on this program. Mobile service made easy is their tagline. And they're basically an alternative to the sorts of big companies that have been determining how cell phone service works pretty much since cell phone service started. Ting is part of, well, something you would expect in a more mature industry. As the cell phone industry matures, they are a customer service-oriented outlet. Basically, that's how they compete with their competitors. They do a better job of treating you well. I mean, take, for example, the way they handle contracts. You don't have one. You don't like the service, you leave. That's pretty easy on your part, and yet puts some pretty important demands on the provider of the service. After all, they can't just, you know, sign you up, lock you in, and forget about you. They have to keep you happy or you're going away. Right there, you have a better relationship in terms of, you know, your ability to define the terms right from the get-go. How about the fact that you can pretty much look at your bill and realize what you're dealing with? No mysterious line items on your bill, no add-on charges, those kind of things that make the other cell phone companies a ton of money. That's the sort of stuff that Ting gets rid of. Why? Because it's an advantage to them to treat you better. I mean, if you're locked into a bad deal, Ting will start the relationship off right by helping to get you out of it. They'll give you up to $75 to get out of your old contract, free you up so that you can have a relationship with a company that doesn't lock you into the deal. There's no bundling or ride-along services. There's a very good online support tool that has been used by people who may exist as part of this program There is no-hold customer support that also may have been tested by somebody who possibly may work in this program. Unlimited devices on one plan. In fact, the latest news that I have from Ting is that they now have GSM service support. So what that basically means is that if the kind of cell phone you use wasn't applicable to Ting's service, it probably is now. Now about 80% of devices out there, including the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, will be able to come to Ting through their new GSM network. So why don't you check it out? After all, you have nothing to lose but maybe a significant portion of your current cell phone bill. Go to dancarlin.ting.com and get $25 off your first Ting device when you sign up.
Want to help the podcasts? Just buy your Amazon.com products through the Amazon search window on dancarlin.com, and Dan and Ben will get a percentage of what you spend, and it won't cost you a penny more.
If you think the show you just heard is worth a dollar, Dan and Ben would love to have it. For less than the price of a cup of coffee, you can help keep the common sense coming. A buck a show. It's all we ask. Go to dancarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.